letztlich im Philanthropie sogar. Weil uns hier vorhin die Menasse Verri schon sommer auf der Christ in Lieben weiß and one thing we should consider in our appointment to the commission and then we'll walk you through the questions, answers. Want you to be precise. Don't have to give us a thesis. We know you are capable of doing that as a professor. Must just be pointed really so that we can conserve time. If I think you're over elaborating, I think I will. But we'll try and make sure that we get the gist of what you need to convey. Please, where are your hands, Paul?
Thank you very much indeed, and I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me for an interview and shortlisting me for the process. Really, my whole history has been about human rights. Growing up in South Africa, living in a divided area, going to a whites-only school, my background in terms of where I come from, my mother was a city councillor in Durban, so I grew up very much in the ethos of the anti-apartheid movement. I was very much part of those particular issues while at university, took part in many demonstrations and many other issues, went to the University of Natal, went to law school at the University of Natal, and in fact one of my first assignments was, shortly after I graduated, was to help students who'd been arrested for demonstrating in Durban during a state of emergency. So very much my background is very much a human rights one. I then studied overseas at Harvard during the state of emergency. My background, my thesis was on the role of judges during the South African state of emergency in terms of mitigating the effects of the apartheid regime. I then worked at the legal aid clinic at the University of Natal. I then started at the University of the Western Cape in 1990, coming back just as the announcement of the regime change and the release of Nelson Mandela happened. I then spent 19 years at the University of the Western Cape doing a range of human rights issues, but also working in civil society on a range of particular organizations. The one that Parliament probably would know me best was the Human Rights Committee, where I often appeared before this committee, safety and security, a whole range of issues, particularly between 1994 and 1998, on what the human rights response ought to be on particular pieces of legislation. I chaired the Human Rights Committee, which was known formerly as the Human Rights Commission, which was known before that as the Detainees Parent Support Committee, from 1994 to 1998, and chaired and directed the advocacy arm of the organization. My work in terms of human rights has also saw me do a whole range of other things. I was, for example, appointed in 2008 by the Human Rights Council as a member of the Working Group on Enforced Disappearances, and in July this year, the group elected me as the chairperson. In terms of my academic interest, I've written 12 or 13 books, all having human rights focus, many, many articles. This year, for example, I've written 13 or 14 journal articles dealing with human rights issues, including indigenous rights, achieving reconciliation, dealing with the San community in Botswana, the caste system in India, achieving reconciliation in Iraq, a whole number of questions. So really I've had a very diverse background as both a practicing attorney, and in that regard I've been assisting the Herero community of Namibia with their claims for reparations. I was assisting the various communities in the DRC in relation to the drafting of the constitution. I just recently published a book on the Herero case for reparations. So in a nutshell, those are the kind of issues and really one of the reasons why I really want to play a part on the South African Human Rights Commission. Certainly, in terms of what I could offer, certainly my international exposure, my commitment to human rights, my strong platform in terms of knowledge on the issue, experience on the issues, my ability to work on a range of African issues as well. I'm very close and working directly with the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, the New African Court on Justice and Human Rights, on human rights systems in other parts of the world, and I believe I have a lot to offer the Human Rights Commission. But I also believe that it will be good in terms of what I would learn from the process as well. Certainly the link between practice and the academic side has been an important part of my life, and I believe that being able to play a more direct role in terms of the development of human rights issues in South Africa would be a key part of why I've applied for appointment to the commission. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Professor, and thank you for coming in at such short notice. We really appreciate it. You have a very, very impressive CV, and many of us know you from your appearances here in the Parliament, and I'm sure you feel very at home. May I just ask you just at the outset, with the busy schedule that you have, I'm going to put a number of questions to you, but just the issue of whether you'd avail yourself as a permanent or a part-time member, that obviously is very important. Then secondly, you're fully aware of the mandate of the Commission, and what I'd like you to comment on is how you see the relationship between the Commission and the Executive and Parliament. As far as the Executive is concerned, obviously it is very important for the Commission to report on the progressive realization of the second generation rights and the difficulty that the Commission has had in obtaining reports from departments and of seeing that progressive realization. How would you follow that up in possibly a more efficient way, particularly as well when it comes to the access to information element? And then the second issue relating to the Executive is the thousands of complaints that are laid with the Commission, and many of whom the Commission is unable to respond to because of a lack of response from the departments. They have their powers. How would you pursue that further? Thirdly, would you, at what stage would you consider litigation from the Commission's side? That's relating to the Executive. Then relating to Parliament, we have the Commission appears before the Justice Committee, but surely there's a greater degree of relationship that can, how would you see that developing, particularly when it comes to the reports that are filed? I think there's a lot of improvement that is set out in the ad hoc committee, and lastly, have you studied that and where a lot of these weaknesses have been identified in the CAD ASMO report on Chapter 9 institutions? It's quite a mouthful, but thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm wanting to serve as a permanent member of the Human Rights Commission, but should the committee not feel that I was the right person for a permanent, I'd be willing to serve part-time. So I don't really have a particular need to serve in one or the other capacity. My choice would be permanent. I really would like to devolve my full-time attention to the work of the commission. But should that not be possible, I'd be happy to serve as a part-time member. Certainly, many of your questions really relate to the ASMAL report. And certainly I've studied in a great deal of detail. Certainly a lot of my work over the last 14, 15 years has really been devoted to the Chapter 9 institutions. What role do they play? How to ensure that their powers are improved? How can we improve the mandate, the effectiveness, the institutionalization? A range of particular issues as far as the Chapter 9 are concerned, and particularly the Human Rights Commission. And if you look at my CV, you'll see that there are many, many articles I've written and many, many talks I've given on how to improve and develop the range of institutions. So certainly, to touch on some of the questions that really arise out of the ASMAL report, but certainly you've raised them specifically. Certainly in terms of the mandate and the relationship between the Commission and the Executive and Parliament, I believe that there's a tension that exists between independence and accountability. And certainly the fact that the Human Rights Commission reports to Parliament on a yearly basis certainly is one part of the accountability. But certainly I believe that the relationship between the Commission and Parliament and the other institutions would be increased and would be improved by greater developments and greater relationships and greater meetings between the institutions. It doesn't have to be always a formal hearing or a formal committee session, but certainly having ongoing discussions, particularly on particular issues, would be particularly useful. Certainly the ASMAL committee and the ASMAL report shows a deficiency that the Commission really comes once a year for a two-hour period to report on its yearly approach, and that really, you know, is quite minimal in terms of trying to develop and trying to ensure a greater accountability. Certainly, I think there would be a greater achievement for all sides if the Human Rights Commission would appear more often, not only where there was a hearing on a particular piece of legislation or there was a piece of an international treaty that was being working through the process of ratification. Certainly those developments are useful, and I think having the staff from the Treaty Liaison Office of the Commission is important. But seeing the commissioners coming more often, having a relationship with parliamentary members, with the executive, with government departments, I think would improve the status of the Commission, the work of the Commission, and certainly ensure that the role of the Commission in terms of the work of Parliament and the National Executive could certainly be improved as far as that's concerned. So certainly I think that's, you know, an important relationship. To focus on your question on the development of socioeconomic rights, certainly the Commission has responsibility in terms of both the constitutional angle, developing its relationship in terms of sections 184 of the Constitution, as well as the responsibilities given in terms of the Act of Parliament of 1995, but also the Information Act and the Development of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act. And certainly in all those areas, I believe that the Commission could play a much more vital role with Parliament and the National Executive and government departments in ensuring development of those particular areas. Certainly, as I said, having the Commission coming once a year to do its all-encompassing report on its national report or its yearly report is quite limiting. So certainly the socioeconomic rights part, I believe, is a fundamental part and probably one of the most crucial areas of the work of the Commission, and certainly that could be improved by having greater interaction with the various role players. In terms of your specific question on socioeconomic rights, how to get government departments more on board in reporting, in playing their part, in ensuring that the Commission's work in ensuring that socioeconomic rights are being effectively endorsed and followed through. Certainly the ASMAR report shows deficiencies in terms of government departments not doing what they ought to be doing in terms of reporting to the Commission. You asked whether I thought litigation was a good strategy, and I'm not in favor of litigation as a first resort or even as a middle resort. I would think as a final resort. Certainly the ASMAR report showed that there are a number of other strategies, including using the Speaker of Parliament, using this committee, using a number of other strategies to get government to respond as far as socioeconomic rights are concerned. I don't think the litigation ought to be the first strategy. I do believe, however, believe that the Human Rights Commission could use litigation arm in certain particular matters. But I'm not in favor of it becoming a major litigation tool. Using it as a method to achieve change and getting on board where other organizations, civil society, are looking to take matters for announcements by the Constitutional Court on what a particular area is, what the mandate of a particular institution is, and those issues would be helpful. So certainly in terms of a range of particular issues, I think the Human Rights Commission could use a litigation strategy, but not to force people into doing certain things, but to broaden out people's understanding of particular rights, to find where there was a weakness as far as a particular right and its enforcement is concerned. So those are particular important issues. Certainly just in terms of your last issue, in terms of the ASMAR report broadly, I think the ASMAR report makes some very good findings in terms of particular issues that the Commission could look at. So certainly collaborating with other Chapter 9 institutions, and certainly that would be fundamental. In terms of complaint procedures, the Commission has developed and broadened out its number of complaints it deals with. But certainly linking to the Public Protector, the Commission on Gender Equality, even the ICD, the Complaints Directorate, all would be helpful in terms of dealing with those particular matters and streamlining the process. Certainly developing its relationship with civil society organizations, redeveloping a strategy around the Section 5 committees. I think that those are particularly useful to bring in other people from other institutions, from civil society, to work on those particular matters. So I think there are a range of other issues which the ASMAL committee, you know, looked at. I just name one or two, you know, strengthening the Human Rights Commission's Act, developing further its regulations, making sure it's applicable with the Public Finance Management Act, a range of particular issues which I think the ASMAL Commission really pointed out and needs to be developed further. Thank you very much indeed.
Professor, I'd like you to look at a specific, specific problem areas for us. Only a decade and a bit after transition and the creation of the Bill of Rights, we have a situation where people sit in prison for up to a decade, and in their numbers, awaiting trial, where conditions in our prisons keep us awake at night. And my question to you is, what could the Human Rights Commission do in respect of the criminal justice system, through which agencies, ourselves, whatever? And then a question out of curiosity, because of the work you did with the Herrera alien torts claim. Would that have been in the United States if it's an alien torts? Would you not like to give us your views on the current progress of the actions in the United States, which were first opposed by the previous ANC government and is currently apparently supported by it? Just give us your views on that.
Sure, absolutely. The first question relating to the criminal justice system, there are a couple of issues which I want to approach before I deal with the criminal justice system itself. And for me, one of the fundamental work or aspects of the work of the Human Rights Commission is around human rights education and developing a human rights culture. And certainly the ASMAL Commission pointed out that only about 50% of South Africans know about the Human Rights Commission. So certainly, I believe that one of the fundamental aspects of the work of the Commission going forward would be to develop a greater profile among South Africans, but also to ensure that more South Africans are human rights friendly and want to ensure that human rights are at the major part of where they live, where they work, where they go to school, the recreation that they do. And I believe that will have a dramatic effect on crime. So dealing with crime is an important arm of dealing with the criminal justice system. Certainly dealing with the causes of crime and finding ways of ensuring that less people commit crime is a fundamental aspect of ensuring that the criminal justice system is working. So for me, it's not simply about dealing with the criminal justice system. It's dealing with the system as a whole. And providing and ensuring that human rights education, for me, is a crucial aspect. Certainly the Human Rights Commission played a fundamental part in ensuring that the school's curriculum contains human rights education, but to ensure that it's not simply on the curriculum, but it's actually developed, actually taught, that there's a greater fundamental aspect of children receiving the education around human rights, and it becomes part of their lives, is important. Certainly to tackle the question of the criminal justice system specifically, and the question relating to awaiting trial prisoners. In fact, I published a book last year on human rights in African prisons, dealing with prisons across the continent, but obviously part of it is about South Africa, and specifically I then was asked by the South African Labour Bulletin to specifically write an article for them dealing with South African prisons. So I have, I believe, some expertise in the area. Certainly our numbers in prisons have gone down over the last 3 or 4 years, but certainly we're still about 14th in the world as far as our confinement rate is concerned. So that is, in terms of every 100,000 South Africans, we are incarcerating somewhere in the order of 325 people, which we are second or third in Africa. So certainly we need to find ways of doing that. So certainly I believe working with the Inspector Judge of Prisons would be fundamental as far as that's concerned. Finding ways of reducing violence in prisons would be crucial as far as those issues. Certainly working as far as rehabilitation is concerned in prisons and providing human rights education in prisons would be important aspects. Certainly working with this institution, working with the executive, working with government departments as far as providing whatever is necessary in terms of both education, in terms of training, in terms of a range of issues to ensure that more could be done to stop people going into prison in the first place, and second of all, to ensure that the recidivism rate of people coming out of prison is not as great as it is at the moment, because it's very high indeed. So we need to have, I believe, a multi-strategy approach to dealing with these issues. I believe the Commission should be working closely with civil society. There are many very, very good civil society organizations who are playing a key part of these particular issues. I believe that there are ways of reducing the number of approximately 48,000 people who are awaiting trial at the present time who are in prison. Many, you know, have very low bail amounts, and ways could be found to reduce those bail amounts, because bail is meant to ensure that people will return for their trial hearings. It's not meant to penalize them if they can't afford bail. So I think even educating our magistracy, where majority of cases, and I mean, in fact, I know the magistracy very well. I was part of a program in training magistrates for many years. I assisted the Law, Race and Gender Project at UCT for many years. I've done evaluation projects on a range of particular issues. Many of my former students from UWC are magistrates all over the country. So working closely with them, sensitizing them to these particular issues is, I think, an important role that the Commission could work closely with. Working with the Magistrates Commission in terms of those particular issues as well. Obviously, the question of independence of these particular institutions is important, but I believe a collaborative approach would be most useful in trying to address many of these particular issues. Thank you very much. Yeah, it is. Yes. Certainly my interest in the Herrera case has made me follow the South African litigation very closely. Certainly I believe those cases are important. Certainly from a strategy point of view, the Herrera cases have been important because we've in fact seen that it's found ways that those we've sued have been willing to talk to us and to ensure that some type of settlement can be reached, and some type of, you know, compensatory plan can be arrived at in terms of those issues. So certainly I believe that the South African case before the United States courts are important. I believe that they should have gone forward. In fact, I've at times provided some expertise to the Kulamani support group on those particular matters. So I've been broadly supportive of those particular cases, but in other ways as well, I believe that some type of settlement ought to exist. In some ways, those cases could have some negative economic effects on our country for investors and for long-term economic development. So while I'm supportive of them, I believe that victims ought to have some particular benefits, particularly where there have been direct correlations between companies that have provided specific aspects where human rights violations were committed by the apartheid state. I believe that there should be some way down in terms of redressing victims' needs in terms of those issues. And obviously it fits into our broad need for socioeconomic transformation. And certainly there's, I believe, some responsibility for those who carried out human rights violations during the apartheid years to find some ways of redressing those particular issues.
Thank you, Chair. Professor Sakian, you indeed have a wealth of information in handling and solving what I would like to call socio-pathological phenomena in this country. Could you do the panel a favor by adding your views, comment on the relevance and usefulness of the Human Rights Commission in respect of the Domestic Violence Act? Can it play any role there? The second question is, do you consider yourself well equipped to handle human rights connected with African traditional law and custom? The third question, please, Professor, while not challenging your integrity, tell the panel about your strengths and weaknesses. And the last question, using your rich knowledge, how do you see yourself promoting the Human Rights Commission and the culture of human rights in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Your first question relates to domestic violence, and certainly I see the role of the Human Rights Commission in terms of what I would broadly term vulnerable groups as being particularly crucial. Certainly, South Africa's history of violence against women, but domestic violence generally, is very high. Certainly the fact that we've abolished corporal punishment in schools is particularly useful. I don't think we've always achieved, you know, the level of satisfaction with actually ensuring that corporal punishment in schools ended. But, you know, the decision by now Chief Justice Langer on corporal punishment in 1995 was a particular advance, I think, in terms of domestic violence generally. So certainly we have very high gender violence in this country. Certainly our number of rapes committed annually is, you know, way beyond what it ought to be. To link to Mrs. Smuts's question, you know, we don't prosecute enough people for rape and domestic violence. So certainly I think we should be improving our domestic violence legislation. We need to improve our reporting mechanisms. We need to ensure that police do more follow-up. We need to do more about the use of firearms in relation to domestic violence. We need to remove perpetrators who commit domestic violence far more quickly from homes. We need to provide protection to those who are subject to domestic violence, both men and women and children. We need to provide, you know, protection to the aged. The aged in terms of domestic violence is also very problematic. I can go on quite a lot in terms of domestic violence. Certainly in terms of African tradition, African customary law, African customary issues, I've dealt a lot with those particular issues. So, for example, one particular issue that comes to mind generally, I wrote a book about the South African amnesty decisions, and only looking at amnesty. I didn't look at the TRC broadly. But one of the issues I explored, and I dealt with one particular chapter, was how there was the interplay between customary law and witchcraft as dealt with by the amnesty committee. And, you know, I thought that that had been an area which nobody else had looked at. So certainly in terms of giving benefits and giving highlights and giving focus, I believe that I would be somewhat equipped. I wouldn't be as equipped not growing up in an African traditionary background, but certainly growing up in KwaZulu-Natal, having spent a lot of time in rural areas, working on legal aid places, providing those particular issues, working in Pietermaritzburg, working in Stanger, working in a range of particular places, doing training for a range of particular institutions around those particular issues, I believe I'm somewhat capable and would like to play a greater role, but believe that there ought to be a greater infusion between what I call civil law and customary law, and there ought to be a great development of those particular issues. Certainly I believe that customary law is not given its full recognition and more ought to be done. So certainly I would support greater absorption in our ordinary courts of customary law, the use of indigenous languages, and all those particular issues would be helpful as far as those issues are concerned. Your question of strengths and weaknesses. Certainly in terms of my strengths, certainly I think my background, my experience, my research ability, my media exposure, my international exposure, my work on range of issues is particularly important, and I won't go more into my strengths. I think I've talked about my strengths. Certainly, I think a weakness is sometimes I'm too passionate about a particular issue. Certainly, another weakness which some people say is I work too hard and I try and get too many things done at the same time. Sometimes I spread myself too thinly on a particular issue. So those are, I think, some of my weaknesses. Yeah, I think, you know, my family says sometimes I put my work sometimes before what, you know, they see as important. So finding a better balance in my life sometimes would be some of my areas of weakness. And the last question relates to a human rights culture. And as I said, I believe that's a fundamental work of what the South African Human Rights Commission could do. Developing human rights education broadly. And to tie back to your question relating to African tradition, African culture, I think one of the weaknesses has been lack of access to rural areas, lack of bringing the commission into parts of our country, the Eastern Cape, the Northwest,
the northern parts of KwaZulu-Natal, the Northern Cape, those particular areas. You know, we need to ensure that there's greater training in those particular areas, more access to justice, more access to people being able to access their rights. So certainly, I believe that would be one way to enhance the work and enhance the development of a human rights culture in South Africa. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Chair. Actually, he's anticipated some of my questions. I just want to know how many African languages or how many of the official languages do you understand?
I understand two, English and Afrikaans. I can understand a bit of Zulu at times, having grown up, but not very strongly. So it's really those two. You know, it's one of my weaknesses always is language, particularly working in the United Nations system. I get criticized for not speaking another UN language, either French or Spanish or Russian or Chinese. So certainly, you know, having spent most of my life focusing very much on law and human rights, I didn't spend any other time developing other languages, and that, I believe, is certainly a deficiency. And certainly, hopefully over time, I can develop those particular issues more. But certainly, that's a weakness that I do have.
Professor Salkin, do you think the traditional courts law is giving customary law its rightful recognition?
At the present time, not really. I think there's more to be done around traditional leadership, developing customary law issues, developing the rights and role and places that traditional chiefs and headmen and other individuals ought to play. Certainly the key kind of tension between gender issues as well. How do you integrate gender into customary traditions? But certainly, as I said earlier, ensuring that we integrate far more our South African people into our framework, developing the greater integration of people in the rural areas, giving them a sense that we're an all-inclusive society, ensure that we show that we're a tolerant society, that we ensure that our constitutional democracy is transformative, that we ensure that all the languages, including our 11 national languages, but the other languages which are incorporated into religious communities or others are given far more important place within our society. So certainly in terms of traditional issues, traditional languages, culture, language, all those things I think need to be given far more central place in our society, and more can be done by the Human Rights Commission, but by other institutions to ensure that there was more in that particular direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One feels uneasy in asking questions of Professor Salkin, whom I've known by reputation and by work for a long time, and I'm most pleased to meet personally on this occasion. In the ordinary course of business, he would be the one asking questions to me as a professor to a student. But being as it may, my questions are not about the his expertise, which I think is beyond dispute, but really what would he do in directing the Human Rights Commission if he were appointed. And in that respect, I want to put something to him through you, Mr. Chairman. We had many people coming, and the feel emerged that there is almost consensus on the commission being an advisory role to playing an advisory role to government, educating, reaching out for people, and avoiding litigation unless it is the last resort. And we heard this time and again. Yet the primary job of the commission is that of protecting human rights. Whenever we talk about protection of human rights, we refer to cases. I mean, the corporal punishment case, the same-sex relationship case, the HIV case, the capital punishment case, I can think of many, all the various immigration law cases, the refugee law cases. In all these cases, which promoted and entrenched jurisprudence, the commission was nowhere to be found. The Dalai Lama case, nowhere to be heard before. A right is only a right when it becomes justiciable. And having spent 10 years on the other side in government, I know that government waits until it's told what to do by the court, not by the Human Rights Commission. By the same token, parliament, the political process has got its limitations. It's very difficult to deal with issues like same-sex marriages, even though the Constitution is absolutely clear about it. So at times one relies on the court to take the hot potatoes out of the pan. And in that, because the Human Rights Commission has been outperformed by the various NGOs and private initiatives. So I'm just putting this to you to see how you would react to the statement.
Absolutely. You know, as a lawyer, one would have to say that you have to go to court at various times. But I think, as you said correctly, the question is when and in what particular circumstances would the Commission go to court on particular matters. There's a great deal of perception, and I think you've picked up on that perception, that the Human Rights Commission hasn't played its part in terms of developing the case law around the Bill of Rights specifically. And there have been criticisms that on HIV/AIDS in relation to the TAC cases and others, the Commission did not play its particular part. So, as I said in relation to the very first question, as said by Mr. Swart, I think that the Commission could play a litigation role to expand rights, to ensure that we know what the extent of a particular right is. So where there is a particular case which that the Commission believes is important, or a range of other civil society actors believe that a case is important, I believe that the Human Rights Commission ought to play a part as far as those issues are concerned. Certainly developing the Commission's role as far as a litigator in the court should not become a preeminent part of what the Commission does. It ought to be one of its set of tools that it uses. Certainly, there are many issues. So if I just talk about one or two issues which I think there's been less of a focus on, the development of the rights of children, the rights of the aged, the question of the extent of the rights to food and water, for example, very under-litigated in our country, and there could be some kind of case brought forward so we know the extent of the rights that exist within our Constitution. To some extent, my problem with using the litigation strategy would be where the South African Human Rights Commission became an antagonist in the process. In the early days of the South African Human Rights Commission, it had its hearing, for example, on the media. And it really created a lot of kind of unhappiness with the role of the Commission. So I think the Commission ought to do litigation strategically, where it was useful, to expand rights, but not in ways which would really undermine its credibility, undermine its effectiveness, undermine its independence, undermine its strategy in terms of a range of particular issues. I believe the litigation should be strategic, in terms of combining it possibly with other Chapter 9 institutions, and at times with important civil society actors. So certainly I would be in favor of the Human Rights Commission taking on particular cases, particularly where there are enormous gaps in relation to some of the areas, but not in the way where it becomes an antagonistic plaintiff in cases which really undermines much of its good work in terms of building relationships and doing the human rights education on the ground, which is so sorely needed.
Thank you, Prof. Again, we are grateful to have had the opportunity with you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed, and good
luck. And thank you to the committee for giving me the opportunity. Thank you. Yes, indeed. My colleague over there, Mr. Holanisa, and I was at the university together.
discussed about the Sendo Conference. I'm told the judge is willing to come back on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. He's returning sometime, so maybe
I received a call from Judge Zulman saying that I am prepared to come down on Thursday. I was suggesting that he can be available for an interview around about 12 up on Thursday. 12.
Yeah, I'm getting very serious. Yes,
I thought we were
deliberating. Yeah, we are. That's the problem.
I don't think we should cancel our deliberation time. Because our deliberation time is almost more important than the interface.
I think what we want to do, even before we go to Caucasus, is to begin to say to one another, these are the possibilities that we can look at. And I don't know, we want to do that, but it is very important that we do. We might have to begin to discuss tomorrow evening certain possibilities, even without interview other people. Informally, yeah. I just think we need to do that and see what is possible. We might find that we don't have a lot of time. We may not need a lot of deliberation. We might remain with some sort of an agreement without a lot of fish throwing. Yeah, we'll see. So we don't have we'll take on board the questions of friends. The person who was to be here yesterday, who didn't, I'm told she is back in town this evening. But I decided we're not going to interfere. But in the light of the decision we took earlier about the one who is playing, it becomes a so we can interfere because she'll be here for some other reason. No, it's okay. We'll do that. No problem. Yeah.
May I make
Professor? What is happening to you? Ah, you'll miss the boat. It's in Sweden until the port.
I thought that perhaps we could also utilize the time on Thursday before caucus. I mean, I don't mind coming earlier. Yeah, even 8 o'clock, then we can.
No, let's do 9 o'clock. Let's try 9 on Thursday. Let's meet you at 9. Okay. Just stretch our feet while we can.
If I were only in Parliament, but I wasn't at the head arranged meeting for Lord Bishop. Thank you.
Members of the committee are displayed prominently in front of each of them. Briefly, just give us your background. Of course, you've gone through the CB, so bear that in mind and tell us about your experience in human rights. Again, briefly. And why you think we should consider you for membership of the commission, excuse me, and what impact do you think you would make if you were to be appointed to the commission. Then we will then walk you through questions and want you to answer in precise terms. Not be long-winded. Give up the gist. The answers. If I think you are over elaborating and interviewing, the exercise is just meant to get us to understand if indeed you are a suitable candidate for the commission, or if you could therefore consider for appointment or recommendation to parliament for appointment. So, I'll hand over.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the invitation. It's an honour for me to be here with you today. As you know from my CV, I used to be in Parliament, and I'm very familiar with this particular venue. Now, I did include a CV in my nomination. I'm also known to some of you, whether it's an asset or a liability, I don't really know. But I'll start off. I was born in the year when the Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed in the United Nations. It's also the year in which the National Party came to government in this country, so the one was an asset, the other, unfortunately, not. I grew up on a sheep farm in the Bakkerstroom district, which is on the border of KwaZulu-Natal, but it's in Mpumalanga. And fortunately, I picked up the Zulu language as a boy, playing with the children of the laborers on the farm, which has come to good stead to me in later life.
boarding school from the age of 5. And after I matriculated, I went to Pretoria University, where I studied law. After that, I joined the Department of Foreign Affairs, where I stayed for 13 years. I served in various capacities, the last being consul of South Africa in Spain. I then resigned in 1982 to take up farming. And in the meantime, I also started a legal practice in Volksrust, which is a rural town near the farm. I got involved in agriculture, in organized agriculture, and I served in various capacities there. The detail is in my CV. But I want to stress that because I will later come back to my role in agriculture. And as a lawyer in a rural area, I got to know the plight of people in rural areas. I will also come back to that a little later. I was elected a councillor to the Pichilingasema municipality in the year 2000, and in 2004, in February, I came to Parliament. I was appointed in the vacancy created by Dr. Benengubane's appointment as ambassador to Japan. And in Parliament, one of the first things I did was to table a private member motion trying to protect RDP homes against execution steps. It was approved by the committee, but it unfortunately didn't get past the Department of Justice. I believe it's still in the process. I served in various committees here, Foreign Affairs Committee being one, and then this committee, the Justice and Constitutional Development Committee, I also served there, and also in the Constitutional Review Committee. I served in various ad hoc committees. I think the last one was the one I served with some of the members here, was when we had to appoint only one commissioner to the Human Rights Commission. That was in November last year, I think. That was when Greg's governor was appointed. Detail you can get from my CV, but this is more or less. There's one thing I forgot to say. My Zulu name is Nkomiyahlaba. Professor Ramadaba.
Nkomiyahlaba. That's what I say, right?
Yeah. DPS wants to do it.
Thank you, Chair, my donkey, and quite welcome. There's no, doctor anywhere. It's quite a luck. But you're a PhD, and quite welcome to the Parliament. It's nice to have you here, your colleague again. I'm sure you feel at home. Just to ask you some initial questions relating to how you see the Commission and its relations with the Executive and Parliament. Now, you recall when you sat with the Justice Committee, when the Commission appeared before us, it had a number of deficiencies that were highlighted in the Cato Ashmore report as well. How would you, as a Commissioner, address some of those weaknesses, particularly relating to the role of the Executive? You'll remember the complaints, there was always thousands of complaints, and the Commission had difficulty in getting responses to those complaints. The second issue relates to reporting by the department as to the realization of second generation rights, where departments are not always forthcoming with that information. And then thirdly, at what stage does the Commission consider litigation if necessary? And then how do you see the role of the Commission vis-à-vis Parliament
We know that they come once a year for 2 hours. Surely there's a better way of doing it than that. Just as some introductory comments. Thank you, Dr. Hubert.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. I think I'll start with the last part first, if I may, Chair. I've been thinking specifically about that. You may remember that in the Justice Committee, I at one stage suggested that as Foreign Affairs really had two committees, we in Justice should try and also expand our committee to have more or less two, one that can do the oversight and the other that can do the litigation. But since then, I've come up with the idea that we should actually have a human rights committee in Parliament. I think that will be very much more hands-on on the committee. If you look at the committee's mandate, it is huge. It is huge. And I think I take my hat off to Mr. Kaplan and his team. There were only four commissioners for the last year, with the fifth one appointed towards the end of last year. How they could do all the work, I don't know. Because originally there had to be something like 11, something like that. So, yes, I think the interaction with Parliament is not what it should be. We used to see them once a year. And also not for a whole day, maybe half a day, a couple of hours. So I don't think we were really hands-on in what was going on in the Commission. The reports were regular and the reports were well prepared and so on, so that's not a problem. But I think also their budget is very small for what they have to do. It's around 55 million, the last one. The present one is probably bigger. So if you consider that against the huge mandate they have, then I think they're doing excellent work. But I think it was Justice Shackleton in the Yihu case, Yihu versus the President of the Republic of South Africa, where he said, it is our goal to create a society that affords equal treatment to every human being based on equal worth and freedom. Now, the word I want to underline there is it's a goal. And I think this is the problem. Much of the Commission's work is really to get human rights, or to create a culture of human rights in South Africa. Now, we started off in 94 with nothing. Really, in the previous government, human rights were not on the table. I started by saying, when the government came into power, they were one of seven or eight states that did not support the Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations. So this is the background that we had. The culture of human rights is still very, very far ahead of us. But we must try and cultivate it. We must try and educate people. Even the criticism against the Human Rights Commission, I think, is also maybe not fair because people don't always understand. And if one can criticize the Human Rights Commission, it's mainly because they're not visible enough. I think they should do much more, because if we look at crime in this country, crime is absolutely high. And what is crime but a contravention of somebody's human rights? Each and every crime makes somebody else suffer. So it's a human rights issue too. Poverty is also, it touches on your dignity as a human being. So the mandate is so huge that I wonder how four or five commissioners could really do anything about it. The thing that I mentioned in the beginning about agriculture, I just want to add that here. You know, we have about 800,000 laborers on farms in South Africa. Now, if you take five people per household, we're talking about 4 million people that can be reached. I think we can start. If there are people who live in such appalling conditions on farms and also in their old homelands. I was recently involved in a case where a person had to be picked up by an ambulance. The ambulance, there was no road, the ambulance didn't even get near the home, so they had to push this poor person in a wheelbarrow until they got to the road where the ambulance could pick it up. Now, that's not equal treatment. We should really try and improve that sort of thing. You asked many questions, I'm in the process, I can reply to all of them.
Thank you. Your remark on crime being a contravention of human rights and a potential role for the Human Rights Commission in addressing that problem at root, I find very interesting, and interestingly you're the second person to say that today, and I think it's a very positive approach to take for the Human Rights Commission. May I ask you about criminal justice at the other end? We have the shocking situation at the moment where people are awaiting trial detainees for up to a decade. Quite intolerable. And we all know that the conditions in our prisons are beyond description and certainly don't lead to rehabilitation. What role would you think the Human Rights Commission can play in that respect? And who should it be interacting with in order to help to address the problems in the criminal justice system? May I also ask you, while we're in the field of justice, I'm reminded by you reminding us that you speak Zulu. Am I right in thinking that you give us your idea on the use of all of our languages in court proceedings? And do I not remember that you once did some groundbreaking work in this respect, with the use of Zulu in a court? Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, again, the last question I'll answer first. It was in the small claims court where all the parties were Zulu speakers, and we didn't have an interpreter that day. But the small claims court is not a court of record. In other words, you don't keep record of the proceedings. So rather than send the people home and wait for an interpreter the next week or whatever, I decided let's do it, and then we did it, and then we finished the case. But there is a problem with some of the indigenous languages, in the sense that I think very few of our judges, for example, except for those whose home language it may be, understand these languages. So when it comes to an appeal, if it is not in English, it's difficult because then you have to look for a specific judge who can handle that case. So I think that's a practical problem. It could also be that some of the technical terms, okay, I'm not a Zulu speaker by birth, or not my mother tongue, but I find myself using English words when I can't get the Zulu words. There are words for most of these things, but they're complicated sometimes. So I think, yes, it can be done, but it will take time. It is something that has to be developed. It's a goal. But it's not an easy goal, and I think in the meantime, we have more pressing things that we should attend to. But it is something that I think needs attention, and it can be done. It can be done. Your problem is sometimes you have a prosecutor who's a Xhosa speaker, then they point him in a Zulu-speaking area. It's not his tongue, so he uses an interpreter. And the interpretation wastes a lot of court time, because everything then has to be repeated in the record language, which is not in the interest of justice always. But then the other thing is the standard of interpretation is also not what it should be. I often had to interrupt and say, sorry, Your Honor, or Worship, I don't think that's what the witness said, because they sometimes interpret things differently. And that's very important. If you miss on that, you can justice will not be delivered. But to get to the criminal justice system, I can't remember whether you were there. I think you were when Deputy Minister Johnny DeLonga, you were not there, when he I think, was a very brave step what he did there, where he pointed out the situation in the criminal justice system. Now, I know they've been working on it. How far they've got, I don't know. But it's like a symphony. It's your police, it is justice, your courts, and it's your correctional services. And if any one of those are not really on top of it, then you have malfunctioning. The courts, we visited courts here in Portsmouth, I visited other courts, they are in appalling conditions. And the overcrowding of those courts, of those prisons, I mean, it's. We must remember, criminals are criminals, but they are still human beings. They have dignity, and I think if you sleep so many people in one place, it can't be healthy. What we have to do is, I think, is approach the whole thing, because at the moment it ends up with correctional services, but sometimes the police arrest people unnecessarily. It's not necessary to detain a person to bring him to court. I think about half the cases, you could warn a person to come to court, or you could subpoena him or whatever. So that can take half away. Then your court rolls. It's not necessary. If you look at the statistics, some of the courts have long outstanding rolls, and some have practically none. So we must go and look at those courts where it is done and implement that in the other courts. So there you can also get some relief. And then sentencing as such, I think we should again look at maybe what do they call the Magistrates Commission, the school, what is that new thing, the Justice Training College or something like that. They should look again at sentencing. Because at the moment it's the easiest thing to send a person to jail. And if you send them to jail for 6 months, you haven't achieved anything except you've got another person in jail. No rehabilitation can take place in 6 months. As a matter of fact, most people come out worse after 6 months. But there are alternatives. You can give them, they can go work in a hospital, clean the floors over weekends. There are many, many, many examples of what they can do. That can also bring down the number of people in prison. And the other case is bail. Bail is sometimes just refused. And then it's a person, well, eventually they give him R1,000 bail. And then he can't pay R1,000. Then he sits for 6 months waiting his trial. So these are things that we can refine. I don't think the system as such is totally wrong. It's just that it's a awful thing. I think this is definitely a human rights commission. As I said, an accused person, well, in our system, is still innocent until proven guilty, has the same rights as other people. So I think maybe it's because they don't have the time or the capacity to do it, but I think really, especially the condition in those prisons. According to law, a person under 18 may not be detained together with other people, but they do it because they don't have capacity and that sort of thing. So I think the first thing is we have to apply the things that we have, the things that worked in the past, we have to apply again. There should be more discipline in our courts. I remember when I started practice, the magistrate walked in 9 o'clock and the court started. Nowadays, can be 11 o'clock. Nothing happens. Then they wait for the witnesses. They haven't arrived, and the prisoners haven't arrived from the prison and that sort of thing. It's in shambles at the moment. But I think this is something for the Human Rights Commission. They should be able to point this out.
Thank you, sir. Forward to
back, you have stressed the importance of the culture of human rights very, very ably. Now, using your qualifications and experience, how will you help to promote the mandate of the Human Rights Commission to protect and to promote human rights and the cause of human rights? That's the first question. Now, the second question, which I think is going to be very easy, because you don't need to refer to any book, tell us about your strengths and weaknesses. And the last question, in my view, the work of the Human Rights Commission is 24 hours round the clock. Now, which implies that most of the time you will be under extreme pressure. How will you handle that pressure? Kindly inform the commission, the panel, whether you can work under pressure without getting off balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. What I will do to promote the function of the Human Rights Commission, if you look at the Act, you will see that the Commission has vast powers. They can subpoena people, they can even entry into their homes and that sort of thing, but they don't really have powers. And I think that's important, because I didn't point that out earlier, because they're an independent organization, totally independent, and they have to be independent. And with the separation of powers, you can't have the Human Rights Commission now becoming a sort of a semi-court or quasi-court like that. I think it is definitely in the interest of everybody that it should remain what it is, which is a negotiating body and an educational body. So I think the best thing, if you take court, for example, it is actually the last place where you want to solve your problems. Because it's not a win-win situation. One party wins, the other party loses. And this is the problem if you take these matters to court, even the equality court. But if you can get a win-win situation, and this is only with through negotiation, conciliation, and that sort of thing. And I think this is the way they do it, but that's not obvious. People don't see it. If the papers don't report on it, you don't hear about it. But to go and sit down with people, I'll take the farmers as an example. If I'm appointed, one of the first things I would like to do is to go and sit down with the farmers in this country. They're very well organized. We have, in every district, you have a farm. What do they call it? Branch of one of the structures. So you have people you can contact and you can talk to them and you can explain to them. These things are basic. I don't know where it went wrong, because human rights is something that your mother should have taught you when you were small. So what went wrong with us, I don't know, but we have to fix it. And the only way I can see fixing it is through negotiation, conciliation, and then education. I'm glad to see that the schools now have a human rights curriculum in their curriculum. So that's important, because then children will start learning from a very small, tender age that there are human rights. Because at the moment what worries me is that the stress is on human rights and not on your responsibilities. If you look at the African Union Charter for Human Rights and People's Rights, I don't know why they have Human Rights and People's Rights, but that's how they call it, you will see they have a Chapter 2 there that specifically lays down your duties. And I think this is important. Even though the Human Rights Commission's slogan or whatever you call that says know your rights and accept your responsibilities, we tend to stress the rights and not the responsibilities. Rights are not absolute. Your rights are bordered by other people's rights, by the community's legitimate needs and so forth. I think that has to be stressed. And if you can get people, my personal motto is, do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. And if I can paraphrase Kennedy when he did his inaugural speech when he was elected president, I would paraphrase this in a slightly different way, and I would like to say, do not ask what you can get from your neighbor. Ask what you can do for your neighbor. If we start to get that type of culture going, I think we can make a big difference. Still remember, it's a goal. Certain of the rights we've achieved, political rights, we're there. When there's very little we can still add to the political rights. But then there are other rights. Health, for example. We still have a situation where there are really two health cares in this country. If you're rich, you belong to a good medical aid, then you can have the best medical treatment in the world. But if you're poor, you get the poorest medical treatment in the world. But we are the same. We should be equal. So you know, it takes time, but that should really in the end be the ideal that we are striving for. Okay. Then, strengths and weaknesses. That's very difficult. I must ask my wife that. Well, I'll start with the easy ones. I'm very punctual. I never late for anything. I think I'm hardworking. I'm loyal. Let's leave it at that. My weaknesses. I procrastinate. What is that thing? My tax return is not ready yet. And it worries me that I don't do anything about it until I get a letter or a phone call. That's about the best weakness I have.
Don't give us a thesis of yours.
Sorry?
Don't give us a thesis.
Okay. Whether I can work under pressure? Yes. If you're a lawyer and you have a case and it all goes wrong, you can't just walk out and ask for an extension of tomorrow, we'll do the rest. Sometimes it goes horribly wrong. A witness comes in, and he witnesses or tells the court the story, and your client never tells you anything about that. And then the pressure is really on. And when you get home, you'll find that your jacket is wet. So, under pressure, I have been exposed to pressure.
No,
I
wanted to ask you, welcome back, Mr. Chabert. Dr. Chabert, now, it's okay, so the CV says not yet completed final thesis to be submitted in the near future. And given what you were saying about procrastinating, I didn't realize you'd...
This is a copy given library.
You've done it, okay. One of the requirements, as you know, of a human rights commissioner is somebody who's shown a proven commitment to human rights. Now, in your CV you say you resigned from the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1983, I think it is, or 82, because you couldn't no longer justify the then government's racial policies, and you then went into sheep farming. That period, 83 to 94, saw some of the worst abuses of human rights in the country's history. Did you do anything about that? I mean, it was the sort of final stages of the uprising against apartheid, the apartheid state trying to maintain itself, state of emergencies declared, I'm not sure you were in Falkirk, I think that was only the national state of emergency in 1986 onwards. But, you know, there was a lot happening. There were enormous human rights violations, both on a political and on other levels. Can you do anything about that? Can you tell us what you did in that period? And the other point linked to that is you were a farmer, so you were on the farms. Before you became active in public life, which seems to be about 2000 when you became a counselor, what did you do regarding the condition of farm workers in your area? You're talking about getting the commission to meet with farmers. Did you do anything about setting up fora between farmers and farm dwellers? Because the human rights abuses in that Falklist area against farm dwellers were also quite extensive, particularly over that period. So my first question then is in the period since you resigned from DFA to 94, what did you do that would show your commitment to human rights? And then secondly, in that period from while you were farming up until 2000, obviously when you became a counselor, there was a duty on you to be involved in public life. But before you had that duty, what did you do to assist the people of that area, in particularly the people living on the farms?
Okay, thank you. First of all, easy answer to that one. I was one of the only farms in that area that had a school on the farm for the laborers' children. But I was, at that stage, I was rather aside. I didn't take part in politics, except for agricultural politics, which is different, where I reached certain positions. I was director, like the chair of Place and Trial, which is a very big co-op. It later became a company. I was a director for BKB, which is the wool corporation, now also a company. And in those boards, I did try my best, because something that may be of interest to you, we use, once a year, we use shearers that come from other parts of the country, mostly from the old Transkei. They come and they shear your sheep for you. And the conditions were appalling, and I took the matter up with BKB so that when you had to accommodate, because for those the week or so you have the shearers that you have to accommodate. And obviously, people didn't want to spend lots of money on accommodation for something they only use 2 weeks in a month. But in the end, we did subscribe certain minimum conditions that farmers had to have if they wanted to make use of that particular facility. But as I say, I was rather more on an island than anything else. I was not aware of any, in our direct area, I was not aware of any violations or anything like that. It's a very rural area with not many people. Even now, it's actually Vakkerskroom, not Falklist. Falklist is the town and district in Vakkerskroom. If you look at your statistics, you'll see that Vakkerskroom district, even now, is a district with the lowest crime rate in the country. I think last year they were the lowest. This year, like, there was one murder, so maybe they were a bit higher this year. So, but I didn't really do much during that particular period, because I had to get myself involved in farming, and through the other organizations, I tried other things to improve conditions. That was the next part of the question.
This was it, basically. But I mean, you know, my difficulty is you're working for DFA, you're in overseas embassies, you're exposed to a lot of media, a lot of politics. You say you resign from the DFA because you can't take the government's racial policies. You then come back and do nothing. And I mean, this is, you know, you're applying for a position on the Human Rights Commission.
20 years later.
Sorry? 20 years later, but it's regarding your commitment to human rights and the evidence of your commitment to human rights. It's very easy to come now and say, okay, this is what I've done, this is what I've been in public life. But, I mean, it's like asking, you know, I think there would be one of the problems the Germans faced during the Nazi period is the question, what did they do? And I want to know what you did from 83 to 2000 to 94. And And as far as the farming conditions, I mean, have you heard of a place called Cornfields, which is very close to Falkshurst? I mean, black spot, up for removals, you know. So I find it a little bit difficult that, you know, you're very anxious now to get the commission involved in working with farmers, but you actually, you know, you're trying to tell us that everything was fine in the Buckstrom area. But anyway, I mean, those are just observations.
Mr. Chairman, I've given the Honorable Super fair notice that I have some concerns about his candidacy. And two concerns, and they both relate to his qualification as a member of the Human Rights Commission. And the one in terms of positive qualification, the other one in terms of negative qualification. This is the first candidate which we are interviewing over, and they're going further schedule, in which it seems that there isn't, wonderful career, obviously a personal stature achieved in his life in many fields, yet there is nothing in his resume which is target specific to human rights, whether it's the legal profession human rights, whether it's the personal acting human rights, whether it's the writing human rights, something which would qualify for the job, other than having been a member of parliament and sitting today amongst friends and colleagues. So that's the first concern, how can be qualified in this sense, following on what the Honorable Jeffrey was mentioning. The second is the negative side, the disqualification, that we as a committee sit with very little guidance from the law and the constitution. What are the qualifications? Coincidentally, we were given today this sort of memorandum from the Democratic Governance and Human Rights Unit, which reminds us of the negative qualification. And it says that there are two of them, that a member must be a fit and proper person, and a member must be a properly representative of the South African community. So these are, and then it's expanded, the fit and proper person, is not acting carelessly or dishonestly, not being divisive, etc. Now, the axe that I have to grind, or the bone that I have to take with a candidate, is that he made a formal pledge on his honor when he accepted the candidacy from the ISP as a member of parliament not to cross the floor. He had the right to cross the floor. He committed himself with the leader of the party not to exercise that right. And in consideration of that, he was given a job to which he would have never been elected. And I can say because I too would have never been elected. I mean, if we stood for parliament with our own parties, I don't think people would have voted for Mr. Joubert, and nobody would have voted for Dr. Ambrosini. Nonetheless, he broke the pledge. He broke the honorable promise on honor. So the question is, how can somebody who has proven this lack of integrity meet the requirement, which is a legislative requirement of fit and proper person, which requires a standard of conduct above what is required of members of parliament? And this is the first part. The second part is, rightly or wrongly, on account of this action on his side, is despised by political parties which represent 850,000 votes in South Africa. And his name is rightly or wrongly perceived as that of a traitor. So how can he meet the requirement of being properly representative of the South African community in respect of the specific constituency which feels that way? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The first part of the question, which is basically the same that Mr. Jeffrey asked, I just want to add couple of things there. You will see from my CV that I was on the Legal Aid Board panel, and now those days we were paid 400 rand per case if you complete the case, finalize the case. But my office overhead at that time was more than that per day. So that was actually charity work that I did, and I included pro bono work,
many, many cases. I was also, mentioned this in the beginning, a commissioner for the Small Claims Court, which is also pro bono work, and which is basically, in that area, basically black people, poorer people that you serve. As far as the RFP situation is concerned, you will know that the IFP at that stage had a caucus of 27 members, and five of those members left the IFP at that stage. I was one of the five. I think those numbers alone give you an idea of what happened there. You know, if five members, that's nearly 20% of a caucus, if they decide to go, then something is wrong, something. I don't know whether you have the same problems with Professor Ndaba Ndaba. I think it was Churchill who said, some people change their parties, other people change their values. I didn't change my values. And I couldn't stay on in the IP. I don't want to get involved in that type of thing. I think those contracts were signed under duress. If you didn't sign it, you were out.
Okay. I think the point has been made.
Human Rights Commission is much higher than is required, which governs the conduct of politicians at home.
Point of order, I think the candidate has responded.
No, I think I've
under duress, and I think that's an important point.
Yeah.
I need to correct, because this is not a statement which can stand. It's an offensive statement that anyone has put any grace on this candidate or any other candidate, or myself. I signed the same contract. Nobody placed grace. It's a grace. It's a condition. You want to be a member, you sign. You don't want to sign, you're not a member.
I think that
I would really request for you to retract the statement of grace, which is an insult to the entire political party and to the system under which we operate.
I assume you to uphold your own...
Dr. Kamrathin... I think Dr. Kamrathin, we have registered your point that there is an issue that worries you, and you have put it on record.
And
I want us to pass. Prof, I don't understand.
Yeah, just a small point here. I think with respect, Honorable Ambrosini has got to withdraw his statement quoting the name of a member of a panel. This kind of argument.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I said that I would have the same problem if Professor Ndaba Ndaba were to sit on the other side. And I see no basis on which I can withdraw the statement that has been raised by the candidate. He raised the name of Professor Ndaba Ndaba and said, why don't you have a problem with him? And I said, I would have the same problem. And so it's not something on which I can see any basis for which I could be asked to withdraw.
Now, I'll follow it for now, but I think we'll discuss it later. Go ahead.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Dr. Joubert, you've been a member of parliament, and even if you were not, as a lawyer and as a farmer, you would be aware of the legislation that seeks to address the plight of farm workers and the people living on farms. As an individual, what have you ever done to ensure that the beneficiaries, the intended beneficiaries of these pieces of legislation, actually get those rights, like getting them land, either on the farm itself or on alternative land, and ensuring that they are not unduly affected from the farm on which they live, besides the school that you do report that you had on your farm?
Thank you. First of all, I've been involved in a number of land claims
not on the landowner side, on the other side I can think of five, and then we're all settled, and people are living there now.
Can I just ask, was that part of your legal practice?
Sorry?
Was that part of your legal practice?
Yes. But you must understand, Mr. Jeffrey, and that's also the problem that I had for those years, ATC, when I just stayed on the farm. If you stay on a piece of land like I had, and you're surrounded by other farmers who think completely different to you, then you're on an island. And you're lucky if they don't burn you down, just if you don't agree with the things they do. You don't have the pressure you have. It's a small community. And everybody knew that I didn't support the government. And that alone was already a no doubt. So it is difficult under such circumstances, unless you have other sources or resources to stand out alone. And I admit, I could have done better, but I didn't. I was too weak. You asked for my weaknesses, Professor. That was one I didn't stand up when I could have stood up. But in time, I also grew up. I think you'll find today nobody voted for the National Party, but they stayed in power for 40 odd, nearly 50 years. So we do. I have grown in life and really have made mistakes. I've made up for it, I think, in all the cases that I did for people. I can show you my books, thousands and thousands of rounds that I didn't collect. I joined the Lawyers for Human Rights. I'm prepared to do work free for them. That's what I'm doing now. I do accept that I could have done more at an earlier stage. Now, we all, many of you, most of you are lawyers. When you're a first-year law student, even later on, you have these ideals that you're going to change life, you're going to make a big difference. But as you start in the career and as you go on, you find out later that, you know, the current has taken you along. And it's only in later in life that some people then get back on track and start again with that idealism that you had as a student. And you can use the law, cases like evictions and so on, you can use the law to help. And we know our fees, Mr. Jeffrey, are really not thousands. It's most of those things, pro bono and for very little.
I want to interrupt. I think we have almost overdone our time with the candidate. I want to take the opportunity to thank you, sir. And wish you luck.
Thank you. Good afternoon, sir. Name is Makura Makoji, chairperson of the committee. And the names of members of the committee prominently stand in front of each of them. Briefly, we would want to tell us why you think we should consider you for membership of the Human Rights Commission. And in so allude to relevant experience. And from there, we'll ask you questions, lead you through. And the only appeal we want to make is that you should be precise and to the point so that we don't lose a lot of time. We're really conscious that. And if I think you're over elaborating in your answers, I shall intervene. Yeah, but that's why we are really. And we start with you, and the commissioners will then invite Owen and Tanana and ask you questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, and the honorable members for the opportunity that you've granted me to attend this interview. Well, I hail from the Free State, in a small place called Harrison. I have had passion to make sure that the human rights abuses that I grew up witnessing come to an end or are limited to a certain extent. To that extent, I then studied law, and I became an activist in the junior years of my life to make sure that really, you know, people receive human dignity in whatever that they do. So I believe I have the qualities, you know, which started far back when I was young. At that time, my participation in political activism was just merely because I saw a group of people being discriminated against by virtue of just nothing else but their race or their origin. I then studied law to make sure that I get an opportunity to represent those people that are discriminated. I then became actively involved in the Black Lawyers Association so that I'm able to advance the very same interests. So I believe the role that I've played, both as an activist, the role that I continue to play in the Black Lawyers Association, and in government in general, gives me an advantage to really understand perhaps what do we mean by human rights, what is it that is that we should adhere to. I don't know whether that has come to.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, and welcome. It's good to have you here. You see the time in Parliament. Thank you for your time and coming to avail yourself as a candidate. Obviously, one of the issues that we need to canvass is your experience and your training relating to human rights and your knowledge of the role of the Commission, the mandate of the Commission. Could I ask you firstly whether you've read the Cater Aspel report on Chapter 9 institutions, which highlights a number of issues relating to Chapter 9 institutions and the Commission particularly? And either yes or no, could you then also elaborate on how you see the role of the Commission and its relationship with the executive on the one hand, and the Commission and its role with Parliament? Now, you will obviously be aware that it is very important for the Commission to monitor the progressive realization of second-generation rights in terms of our Bill of Rights. And to do that, it has to rely largely on departments, reporting from departments, laying complaints from departments. How do you see that relation developing? And the frustrations that have been voiced in the report relating to departments not responding, the executive not responding, how would you as a commissioner deal with that? And then secondly, I noticed that you've got a track record in government. Most of your references are in government. It's not necessarily, it's just that you are on that side. Would you just comment on your experience of promoting human rights in that context. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I have not read the report by Professor Karasma. I believe, though, that the Human Rights Commission has a very important role to play, especially in a society like South Africa, where we are trying to promote social cohesion. There are challenges. We've just been only 15 years out of the very darker period. There are challenges, and I believe that the Commission, amongst others, should really try and educate the South Africans about the human rights issues, the importance of adhering to human rights, issues of human dignity and respect and equality. So I see the role really of the Human Rights Commission before, you know, hitting a people with a whip is to educate. Because it is through education that we are able to bring the different people that are coming from different parts together. So my emphasis would be really we need to educate. We also need to educate the executive on issues of human rights, whether, as you've alluded to, second generation rights, provision of housing, provision of water and other things that are alluded under second generation rights. Yes, I know that there has been the previous chairperson of the commission, Mr. Colapen, there has been frustration, especially with the executive, in the manner in which one not adhering to promotion of access to information acts, for example, not doing necessary manuals. And giving reports to the Commission. I believe, though, that the Human Rights Commission has the power, you know, that the Constitution gives it in terms of Section 184. They also have the power in terms of the Human Rights Commission Act to act where necessary, where they believe that the executive is not necessarily playing a role that it's supposed to be playing. So I believe that the relationship that the Human Rights Commission should have with the executive, one should be cordial, should not be confrontational, because the role of the executive in terms of three organs of the state remains very important, especially when it comes to second generation rights, because as you know, these are called positive rights. And in our preparatory work, when we were working towards the Constitution, some of the well-established democracies have not really included the second-generation rights in their constitution. So they are non-binding. So we need to build on the second-generation rights that the state must give people certain services, whether it's housing, whether it's water, whether it's sanitation, because this is not an easy task to fulfill. If one remembers the Subramani case that went to court, you know, the emphasis of the Constitutional Court was that the state has a duty, but the state must show that what is it that it's doing to achieve whatever rights that people are having in terms of social career, and within the means that the state has. So I believe that we should continue, you know, the Human Rights Commission should continue to engage with the executive in order to enable the executive to understand really its role in terms of human rights culture and promoting that culture within the departments. You spoke also about the role of government departments. The role of government departments is very important. The role of the department where I work in terms of economic rights becomes very important. The role of, you know, adhering to environmental rights, which are seen as third generation rights, for example, becomes very important because that makes sure that our future is secured, that the second the generation that comes after us would make sure that you know, the environment is intact and they can still use that environment. So we need a cordial relationship. We need a relationship that would say, what is it that we could do together? to teach and make sure that we really entrench this culture of human rights. Noting our past, I'm not giving any excuses. I've worked for government for the better part of my life. But we need to make sure that these are entrenched. And to a certain extent, where government fails, we need to take government to account where it has failed. Yes, there are disturbing features where, you know, the reports that government are supposed to give to the Human Rights Commission are not given. And I believe that, we should engage the executive, and if the Human Rights Commission doesn't get cooperation, it has all the powers in terms of the Human Rights Commission Act to act against any organ of state.
Yeah, and you'll follow up, and then Ms. Adams just want to follow up on the same question. So one follows there. Yeah,
but the issue of the Human Rights Act, there are certain deficiencies, and how would you amend the Act to improve the efficacy of the Commission? And could you just explain, because obviously this is a very important document, the Kelly Asma report. How come it is that you haven't read it? Particularly in view of the fact that it's crucial to the future of the Commission and to be participating in that. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks, Honourable Member. The amendment of the Human Rights Commission, I have worked, as you might have seen in my CV, with legislation. Legislation plays a very important role. But what is important to me is to promote a culture of human rights in the country. As is, the Human Rights Commission Act has, if you may, the teeth to bite. But what we need to make sure is to promote the culture so that the executive or any organ of state understands to what an extent, does not doing a certain act affect the people in general. So the amendment of the Act, yes, it may be necessary because what I have seen is still refers to a certain extent to the interim constitution 115 and other things that have not been amended to keep to update with the time. Yes, there may be technical amendments to make sure that, to what an extent do we play in the universal reviews that is under the UN Commissioner. Those are technical amendments. But as to the body and the spirit, I believe the Act has that. What lacks is the cooperation that the Human Rights Commission receives from the organ of state or from the executive. Now, that requires, where I'm seated, it requires the culture of education and making the executive understand the role that it must play in terms of the Constitution and the role that it must play in making sure that human rights culture is entrenched in the country. Not reading the document by Professor Kada Asmal, I really didn't have much time. I got the PMG notice that says it's available, but I just didn't have much time.
My follow-up question was actually asked, because I wanted to know whether you were aware of the existence of the report. But if I may ask you another question, at some stage, you were the Deputy Information Officer for the Promotion of Access to Information Act. What would you consider as the main weakness in that Act for the Human Rights Commission currently?
Okay. The Access to Information Act, requires that departments should make manuals, and these manuals must be available. And all there is for the Human Rights Commission is that it must then, if these if certain organs of state or the departments didn't comply, it just needs to take the report and table it to Parliament. That doesn't give it so much teeth because so many departments have not really obliged that obligation of making the manual. But I still believe, Ms. Adams, that we need to educate. I may be re-emphasizing the point, but we need to educate government departments. The unit of education currently in the Human Rights Commission, I believe, should be expanded. Because in this country, what you need is education. I'm not saying that we should continuously educate people, but the 15-year period, and considering where we are coming from and the agenda that government departments have in general. For example, the information officers are head of departments who have a number of duties to do in a department. They though have the right to appoint deputy information officers. In most departments, what happens is that these deputy information officers are legally trained people, which would be your chief director of legal services or your director of legal services. That's all there is to it. Now, you know, if you get a request like I would normally get, my accounting officer would take the report to me because I serve as a deputy information officer. You know, that's all there is to it. Now, within your realm of what you're doing as a director of legal services, you must still find space to deal with the access to information requests that you get. What has lagged in most departments is that you do not have a dedicated office or unit that deals with Access to Information Act. In my book, I believe that should be reviewed, and we've spoken about it, in the Human Rights Commission when we had a conference on the Access to Information Act, that there needs to be a dedicated office that deals with that because it does so much work for the people that are requesting this information, from the members of the public.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Congratulations for being an activist for a long time. Now, my question is, having been an activist for a pretty long time, how do you see yourself fulfilling the mandate of the Human Rights Commission, namely to protect and promote human rights and the culture of human rights? Using your previous experience. The second question is, could you tell the panel here what you consider as your strengths or strong points and your weaknesses or weak points? The last question, are you able to work under extreme pressure without getting off balance?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks, Honourable Member. Well, my role, I have failed to mention that the adversity we worked under what we call street law projects, which are public advocacy, where we would engage with the Devon Westville prison and see how many of the juveniles that were in that prison that didn't belong to that prison. So I see myself as a human rights activist. Long before I applied or I was nominated for this position, and I continue to do that in various ways. One is just to assist people, as a legally trained people in the township where I come from, on pro bono basis, whether they require certain information legally. This can vary from work, labor rights, and so many other things in the community. So I continue to play that role. I continue to play that role even so within the Black Lawyers Association, which does a number of work, whether it's continuing legal education for graduates at university, whether it's trial advocates for those graduates. So I believe I have been playing the role and I continue to play the role. Because there are a variety of problems. In the Free State, for example, there is a number of, forced removals that are still happening in the farms in the Free State. And that you would get it by accident or you'd get it when you talk to a colleague who works for the Department of Agriculture. And we then try, by all means, one, to put the parties together because... as a country, we must make sure that we build the country, is to put the parties together and try and mediate, so that this farmer really understands the human rights that goes with the tenant that has been staying in a farm for such a long time, the rights that tenant has, because this is important. Like I've said, I've alluded, in a country like ours where we come from different and very painful paths, we need to take each other on board on a number of these issues. Let me cite an example. There is a friend of mine. I visited him on Saturday. He stays next to a white neighbor. The kids, young, 6, 7, have thrown the dog poo on his veranda. He warned them. They continued. He was very angry and very agitated. And I said to him, look, I've got kids. Kids are naughty. Don't look at it in a racial way. Let's just go to the father and report this thing. Then if it continues, you may do something else. So this is the kind of a culture that we must build in a country, because some of these things happen. Whether, you are of the same race, they would happen because kids are just kids. So we're able to do that. So my emphasis is that we need to take different people on board. We are all coming from different cultures. We just need to take each other on board. It is only when people do extreme cases, like what we witnessed at the University of the Free State, there you could then say, look, here it has gone beyond, and these are adults. They ought to have known that these actions must have certain repercussions. So there are two ways of dealing with it, really. The other one is the understanding and really emphasizing the education so that we really move from the dark path that we're coming from. My strengths and weaknesses, my strengths are, I'm an advocate. I've worked in so many advocacy programs. I do that well, and my emphasis on Human Rights Commission having to educate and going on campaigns, I see myself aiding that strength. I don't know where I'm seated in the Free State. We have not really seen so much advocacy by the human rights on so many other issues. There are so many disturbing things that have happened, but what we have not seen is the advocacy and bringing all the interested groups. In my book, you need to bring the Agricultural Union, you need to bring the AHI, you need to bring all these other groups that are seen to be promoting perhaps hate speech and other things on board, so that you really understand that it is in the best interest of the country that we all work together. My weaknesses, and this is a difficult one, it is so difficult to say what are your weaknesses. But naturally, I make my weaknesses my strength. The only weakness that I have now is that I get to concentrate on a number of projects at once. Whether you see that as a weakness, other people see it as a strength because it's called multi-skilling. But I just don't, get an interest in advocating myself in one project. I like having a spread of projects at hand. The third question you had asked, I'm able to come again.
Work under pressure.
Well, I have worked under pressure ever since. I studied at the State Attorney at a very young age. The pressure there is whether you're a candidate attorney or not, you handle something like 100 to 155. I was able to do that. I worked with the Professor Kader Asman as his advisor on higher education. We had, because we had to transform the higher education landscape, we had to work under so much pressure because this was supposed to happen within a certain time frame. I have also served at the presidency where we work under so much pressure throughout the night at times, depending on what the president requires. So I'm able to absorb the kind of pressure, either on litigation or legislative drafting. I've been able to absorb that pressure. Thank you.
Maybe three questions. I see your residential address is I think it's Bloemfontein, Langeboom Park, but first is Harry Smith. Are you still spending time in Harry Smith?
I spend a lot of time with my current father.
Okay. Harry Smith was sort of known as one of the flashpoints of earlier service delivery protests. Have you had any involvement with the Harry Smith community on human rights issues, like socio-economic rights issues, which would be service delivery matters? That's one. Two is it's a requirement that a commissioner needs to be a fit and proper person.
Obviously, when you admitted as an attorney in 2001, that's a requirement for admission. Is there anything we should know about that would cast doubt on whether you're fit and proper? Is there anything, sort of any skeletons or anything? And then lastly, do you support all the provisions of the Bill of Rights, particularly the Equality Clause? And I don't know what your views are on gender issues, equality of men and women. Should pregnant schoolgirls be allowed to complete their education, which has only come about recently? Should people have the right to be atheists if they want to be? What's your view on sexual orientation? So just your views on some of the rights that exist.
Thank you, in Harrismith I continue to be active. We had what we call the concern group. I continued to be active with the people who were in the concern group, sort of giving advice. But with the previous concern group, I was not as active. There's a new group now called Harrismith Socioeconomic Forum. I'm very active in that group. In fact, we have been mandated with a homeboy of mine who is the chief director in the local government and housing, Mr. Mkwena, to mediate between the groups. Currently what is happening is that you have certain people who are not happy with the current leadership of the African National Congress, and those that are deployed or employed in the local government share the municipality. Now this group remains ANC, but they are saying that they don't agree with what other Congress are doing in the ANC. So we've been mandated to go in there and assist. And I have spent most of the time mediating between the two groups, trying to make them understand how local government works, whether other issues that they see as key service delivery points, whether they are achievable within a short period of time or whether they are achievable within a long period of time. The long and short of it, people in Harrismith believe that the Kwakwa faction is well off than the Harrismith people. So you sit with them and show them that the very same challenges of service delivery in Putanjaba or Kwakwa are almost similar, and why sometimes the local government Maludiapofu is seen to be preferring the rural Kwakwa. So I play an active role there. I play a mediation role. I agree with them on some of the issues that they are raising. We may differ with the modus operandi as to how they raise them. They recently had a march, and I had to make sure that really I speak with them on the eve of the march to make sure that it doesn't go out of control, that there is no violence, and they were able to march and there was no violence. So I continue to play that role more of mediation between the all groups in Harrismith. Whether I'm still a fit and proper person, I'm a fit and proper person from the day I was admitted. I have tried and achieved to stay in the right side of the law, both in my conduct and everything that I do within government and outside government. I support the human rights, whether it's equality or issues of gender. I continue to support them. And I believe in a country like ours, to achieve equality, really, we need to look at what we've all agreed on in terms of our constitution. To me, what becomes important is the preamble of the constitution and section 1, which is the founding provisions of the constitution, which says that we need to recognize that the way injustices of the past, and that for those injustices to go away, certain people need to be advanced. So I always say to people, we need to make sure that everybody in this country understands the preamble of our constitution, because in that preamble, you really find the values of what the constitution is all about. Because it says those that have worked, for this developed country or developmental state that we have should be acknowledged, and we should give cognizance to them. Issues of gender, I support them. I've supported them long time ago when I was a student. I've made sure that in organizations where I serve, you know, people are voted because of their because of what they can offer in an organization, whether it's the BLA, whether it's the Black Management Forum. But where possible, you know, we always try to say to what an extent do we advance women within the organizations that I serve. You've spoken about a thorny issue of pregnancy in schools. It's a very difficult issue. You talk to teachers who say to you, government has made or has allowed school kids to be pregnant. Who looks after them? Should an emergency arrive in class? Am I, as a teacher, expected to help? So I believe it's an issue that is very important, but it's an issue that would make us to engage with the teachers, with the principals, because it may be right and correct for us to be saying we are advancing the rights of school kids to fall pregnant and remain in class. But who really looks after them? Young as I am, I have a fiance who is pregnant. I know the challenges of staying with somebody who's almost expectant. There are serious challenges. Now, if we were to put that burden and without assistance leave it with a teacher who is only employed to teach, it may result on other issues. We saw some of these kids giving birth at school. I'm just saying let's open the debate and let's allow all the voices, especially those who remain with the obligation of looking after these kids within the school premises. Let's hear their voice so that we're able to deal with whatever situation that they experience on a daily basis. Sexual orientation, I believe people have a right to, you know, to choose what orientation they want to have. But at the same time, we need to make sure that, you know, there is respect. There are certain people that will tell you that their culture doesn't allow certain things. If you watch Generations, there are a number of our viewers who saw certain episodes and were totally, you know, outraged by what they saw. I believe that we need to make sure that when we talk about sexual orientation and the behavior in general, we should be sensitive to those that see this behavior as something that is untoward their culture. Being sensitive doesn't mean that we are saying that this orientation should not be practiced. But however, we should be sensitive to those that believe that, you know, it is against their culture, for example, to see two men kissing.
Thank you. Just to follow up, Dan.
No, it's a different question, Chair. Oh. Now, okay.
No.
Okay. You seem to be quite active in the rural areas. Did you make any submissions to the traditional courts bill? Have you read the bill? And what are your views about it?
I have not read the bill at all.
Dr. Martin, anything?
I have only reported that you know. No, this is some routine questions that you may, you know, in a press you raised to me as an orator and a debater, so I need to be, don't want to enter into a deep into debate. But if you were appointed as a commissioner, you would be required to give a policy direction to the commission. And there are two things in which I feel the commission will need to find adequate policy direction. And I'm wondering how would you tackle those issues and what direction you would give. The first one is to bring about the concretization of the second generation human rights. Constitution says that they are progressively realized. So it's a line which keeps moving. But where there, where the line exists, or where the line is drawn, there is a right. And that right, being a right, enables the person who is afflicted by an infringement of that right to have recourse to the court. So it comes to a point where the person, where the determination needs to be made that there is enough wealth in the country that the person doesn't receive primary health care and suffers because of that, or dies because of that, he or the estate have the possibility of actually suing the government for failing to comply with that right, comply with that, with the obligation to fulfill that right, and so on and so forth. So how do you see the Commission helping in determining those criteria which enable the judiciary, enable the country as a whole to say, we've done enough, and now these are justiciable rights? And that's on the one hand. On the other hand, first generation human rights. I, for one, you may not agree, but I'm putting that to you to see where how you feel about it and what direction you would give. I, for one, lament the fact that until this point, the Commission has been not as outspoken as it should have been. And has played a role behind the scene, advisory to government, but the strong indignation against the human rights violations and relevant issues came from the NGOs. They took the government to court, the conscience of the country became archbishop to other people who spoken against things which went wrong. And we are faced with abhorrent statements constantly in respect of human rights culture, like the chief of police who says shoot to kill, the president who wants to have children pledging allegiance to the country, the constitution at the age of 10. When no human rights person should be silent, but the commission has been silent. So how do you think do you see the role of the commission being the way it has been, or should it move into a more outspoken and independent role?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks a lot, Member.
However, it will be brief.
The second question of first generation rights, whether the commission has been outspoken enough, well, I believe that there are certain challenges. I have read the annual report of the commission. You have seen a decrease of resources or the budget that has been allocated. If I'm not mistaken, in the past MTF period, they were allocated 14, it went to 11, now it's gone to 10. Now if you reduce the resources of the commission, critical like the Human Rights Commission, that must make sure that it promotes human rights culture and it really entrenches human rights, you are going to have certain challenges. There are certain issues that they be able to attend to. There are certain issues that they may not adequately attend to. So there may be a variety of reasons. But I believe that issues of civic and political rights needs emphasis. As to why the Human Rights Commission might have not covered them to a certain extent or to the satisfaction of the honorable member, it's something that I do not know. But I believe we need to have a balance. And my emphasis would have been, because of the history that we're coming from in South Africa, would put more emphasis on the civic and political rights. In that incremental way, you start with them and then you come to your socioeconomic and then you come to your environmental rights, so that we are able to heal this rift of the past. So I believe that we need more emphasis, but at the same time, there needs to be more allocation of resources so that we are able to achieve what the Human Rights Commission is meant to achieve. The first question, the policy direction on second generation rights. Like I've alluded earlier on, they are what you call tested democracies. Your India and other countries that became democracy way before South Africa thought of even becoming a democracy. They have not put these rights, positive rights, in their constitution. as something that the state must achieve. If you read the judgment of Superman and other judgments where the Constitutional Court have pronounced themselves on this issue, they have said as long as the state is taking reasonable measures within the adequate resources to achieve that right. Now take South Africa. With a number of challenges that we're having on housing, on social welfare, on health, it may be very difficult for any court or for any human rights commission to say to the state, to what an extent are you making sure that there is adequate water to every household, both informal and formal settlements. That is going to take time because it is only a certain number of resources that the state must share with everybody else. But that doesn't make the state not to try and achieve those human rights. I believe we should look at the priorities of delivering the socio-economic rights because these are the rights that touch especially the poor more than they touch those that are rich. So I believe the Human Rights Commission should also look into that, but the state can only deliver that within the adequate resources that it has.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Good luck and thank you again for presenting for us. Thank you very much.
It would need to be full, because you're working for a government department, you wouldn't be able to be a part-time commissioner and remain as a employee of the government that the commission is monitoring. But anyway, let's see if you could respond on that one.
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson and the Honourable Member. I thought about this. I thought we are eligible as government officials to serve part-time. But the Honourable Member seems to be saying that is not the case. If I were to say to serve full-time, I would like to remain in the province. In the annual report I've read, the commissioner who served in the Cape Town office, I don't know whether, if one is appointed, can he serve in the Bloemfontein office. This is because of family commitments, also the role that one still wants to continue to play in the Free State. Not that I'm being regional, but I believe there is a certain role that one can still play meaningfully in the Free State. So if I'm appointed full-time, I would like to serve in the Bloemfontein office, if that is allowed. Whether being a government official, one cannot serve part-time, maybe a different issue.
That's okay. I'm afraid commissioners are going to go back, because it appears like they're reviewing this provincial. So we've noted your desire. Again, the issue of part-time working for government is an issue which we're going to debate. It might influence our decision. Thank you very much. Yeah, we're getting the next candidate, the person who missed the flight. We must use the next 20 minutes to dispose of that person, because the other person is due for 4 o'clock. So we're having Farida Tony. So we're going to try and be brief on our side, asking questions, and I'll try and get her to be brief. Donia. That was the other person is for 4. Let's get Donia.
issues, some of the procedural rights with refugees from Latin America. And also, importantly, I work to set up branches for support groups for the liberation struggle in South Africa, in Ireland, and I work with the ANC and the Women's League in Canada in the ANC mission.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sart.
Thank you and welcome, and thank you for your time. Could I just ask you very briefly, are you at the Commission at the moment? Do I understand correctly from the...
No.
You were there. You've obviously been there for a
while. I was working at the Commission.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could I just ask you briefly, from your experience of working at the Commission, how you see the relationship between the Commission and government and the challenges that resulted in the ad hoc CAD ASMA report? How do you see that? Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's quite a complex relationship with government and the Human Rights Commission. I think historically, as we all know, the Chapter 9 institutions were set up to strengthen democracy. And after the new ANC government came into power, a lot of people who were appointed to the commissions, including the Gender Commission and so on, had close relationship with the political struggle. And because we are funded, the Human Rights Commission was funded through the Department of Justice. It didn't have independent budget that was voted by the National Treasury, for instance. So the relationship was not really very clear at the time, because the Department of Justice helped presidents, and in order to make policy decisions that were relevant to the work of the commission, were sometimes problematic. Another thing, the relationship with government, in my experience and my opinion, we were, in the first 10 years, Parliament was repealing laws and making new laws to entrench democracy and the culture of human rights in South Africa. So lots of legislation, enabling legislation, was very necessary at the time, was being passed. And the Human Rights Commission was monitoring the legislation, policies and programs, and budgets. The competency levels, as you know, in South Africa, are a little much to be desired, because people haven't had that experience. They come from a background where people were deprived of education, not affording them to be able to be competent at their work and to know things and so on. But in spite of that, I think it's done very well that we have advanced, we have made gains, but there are still a problematic relationship within the commission and within government. In my opinion, it's like, besides monitoring policies, programs, and legislation of national government, we should have also been looking at the implementing agencies, like provincial government and the municipalities. And I think because of the lack of that, today we have lots of protest actions and movements and so on. And I think there should be a new vision for the Human Rights Commission. Because one of the fundamental rights of people are social and economic rights. And the Declaration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights talks about an adequate standard of living for everybody, and also to look after the interests and the human rights and freedoms of the poor and vulnerable groups. And in South Africa, because of our past, we have a huge backlog of delivery in all spheres, housing, healthcare, and we have a huge poor population. And these the poverty that the people are experiencing in South Africa does have a huge impact on the development of the country as well. Would you like me to carry
thank
on?
You. Thank, you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, ma'am. Let's get Tim, please.
Ms. Dolly, let me ask you, I'm following on directly now from what you've said about what you saw as a kind of a inevitable flow from the struggle years into posts in governance and independent bodies like this. And I noticed from your CV that you are a member of the ANC Subcommittee on Education and Health. That's an NEC subcommittee, is it? You were, but you'll answer me in a minute. And that you've been working, amongst other things, on the new national health insurance system. And you were doing that directly for the ANC. So, I mean, I would need to understand whether you could separate yourself from the ANC completely, because the Human Rights Commission,
yeah.
That obvious, yeah. The Human Rights Commission has to be independent. It has a degree of independence exactly like that of the court. Then I see a great wealth of experience and knowledge in what you did for the Human Rights Commission. You were the researcher for a lot of their work, especially in socioeconomic matters, and also the editor of reports. For example, are these the kinds of reports? Did you effectively produce many of them?
No, not that one. The earlier ones. I didn't produce them. I sort of edited them and assisted the researchers who were working on different economic rights.
Alright. So to what degree...
Clean up their English.
So what is the degree of your expertise and knowledge? Because you've done so much of it and you did it for a long time before them that it looks as though there's a great, great bank of knowledge. And then the other question from our point of view becomes, are you the right sort of person to translate now into a commissioner who sets strategy, policy, leadership?
Yeah, I just like to clarify one thing, okay? I work for the Human Rights Commission, but since I came to South Africa, I haven't been working with the ANC at all. I work for the DEHAWU, which is the labor union. I was headhunted to work on the NHI, presumably because I lived in Canada, where we have national health insurance, and in Britain. So I had a knowledge of that, an in-depth knowledge of the Canadian system, which DEHAWU was looking at and consulting with. So I did the research work for them when that, the policy paper. They then moved to, it was adopted by the ANC NACC subcommittee. And I think, I don't know how, but this was sort of a gratuitous thing. I sort of floated into the subcommittee on health because of my expertise, and I did it policy papers for improving the public health care system and improving...
Thank you. So if you were to be appointed, the other part of the question, would you get yourself released from those positions in the subcommittees?
I'm already... The subcommittee finished its work and we've handed over all the policy documents to the Minister of Health. So at the moment, I'm not on any committee because that work is not completed and it's gone to the Minister of Health and it's a whole separate process now. Can I clarify that for you? Yes. Yeah, I think I was also very fortunate to win a scholarship to go to the University of Apalache and now as well, studied international human rights law. And that is excellent because it put everything into perspective, the various treaties, the Charter, Organized United Nations, all the treaty bodies and so on. So it's got in-depth knowledge. I don't know if you want me to talk about that. But I think that the role of the commissioner is very important in, I think, setting policy and a vision and a strategy for where we want South African Human Rights Commission to go. what the function of the Human Rights Commission should be. And I do agree with Professor Tada Osman to some extent that we have overlapping functions and with the CGE and with other human rights bodies, and it would be more efficient economically and otherwise to actually have one umbrella organization that would be able to better, I think, fulfill the mandate of the Constitution to strengthen democracy and to promote a culture of human rights. And because all human rights are indivisible and interdependent, women's rights, children's rights, the rights of the disabled, rights of migrant workers, xenophobia, can all be brought under one umbrella organization. And I think it will be also very important.
Thank you. I think you have answered that question. Let's proceed to Prof.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Welcome to the panel. Just two small questions. Now, the first question is, the mandate of the Human Rights Commission, as you know, is to protect and promote human rights and the culture of human rights. Now, how do you see yourself fulfilling this important mandate in terms of your experience and qualifications? The second question is a very easy one. What are your strengths and weaknesses?
I think that what I would do first is to actually review how far we have actually entrenched a culture of human rights in South Africa within government organizations, because the mandate of the Human Rights Commission is actually to ensure that the state's obligations are fulfilled to protect, respect, protect, promote, and fulfill human rights, Section 72 of the Constitution. So I think that's very important, and I think there is, well, I wouldn't say a failure, but there is a big gap in educating government and organs of state in the concept of human rights, like the Department of Environment, for instance, Water Affairs, the police, to educate people much more than we have, because and xenophobia as well, because in my opinion, I think if we had done our groundwork really well, we wouldn't have had all those outbreaks. People would have been aware, much more aware, of the rights of migrants and refugees and so on. So I think there will be a different vision. And I also think that as a commissioner, what I would do is to ensure that the leadership and the vision and the mission of the Human Rights Commission sits within the commission and not in the operational side of it. And the commissioners must have an oversight of what the secretariat and the researchers and other programs, and they must set the agenda for the other programs, set goals and process indicators and outcome indicators. And we must monitor ourselves as well to see whether we are achieving the goals that we are supposed to be reaching.
Thank you.
Fulfilling the mandate of the Constitution.
Yeah, I wanted to answer the second part of the question. The other one, I think, is sufficient. Did I ask you about already, Prof?
Yes,
yeah, I'm there. Yeah, thank you. Doctor?
I'll try to be quick, and I'm going to ask a question that Nicole Lominta would have asked if he'd been here, and it's something that he's been dealing with quite a lot in the past interview, so I'm going to ask it from a different angle. And I've been for many years struggling conceptually with the divide between cultural rights and individual rights. And when asked about cultural rights, the Chief Justice Marshall said, well, aren't they all individual rights? And at times there is the perception that people within the cultural community are somehow entitled to a lesser measure of human rights protection. Now, if you become a commissioner you will need to give direction to the commission. I hold the view that the commission should be ahead of the debate, not lagging behind. Tackle those issues that we as politicians cannot really deal with as effectively, and we can have an eggshell thing that the commission should come down rightly. So, what would you do as a commissioner in respect of the young teenage female Muslim girl who doesn't want to wear a black outfit and wants to rebel against her parents? Will she receive the protection of the commission, the protection of the state? What will you do in respect of virginity inspections and the practice of circumcision and the prearranged marriages of not consenting young women? And these are not isolated cases. The four categories that I gave you include hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
Yeah, well, I think they have precedents already set in South Africa for it's a violation, in my opinion, of the rights of the girl child or of women. And they do have the right to not agree. I mean, you have freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of belief, and freedom of identity. So these are violations of a person's fundamental human rights. And I would protect these people, especially female genital mutilation. I think it's a gross violation, in my opinion.
Thank you very much. We've got done, sir.
Fine.
Now, we're very clear about dentists, and I don't feel intimidated by me cutting you down, but we're looking for the gist, and I think we've got the gist of your answer. And yeah, there is a queue out there. But thank you very much for presenting. I'm happy we have managed to put you through. And I can assure you it will not work against you that we are late. Mr. Klein will understand that. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much. Is it part time or full time? If we get the job, what would full time?
And I'm sorry.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Welcome. We are 5 minutes behind schedule. We just apologize for that. I'm Wangura Matodi, chairing the committee. Names of commissioners, of members, are prominently displayed in front of each of them. We'd like you to briefly walk us through why you think you are a suitable candidate for Human Rights Commission, and just briefly allude to the relevant experience. Then we'll walk you through with questions, and we want you to be focused, precise, not over elaborate. If I feel you're over elaborate, I'm Italian. So, welcome.
Thanks, Chair, and hello again to everybody. Some of the famous faces. I'm just keep it brief. From my CV, I'm an admitted attorney, very reputed advocate. My area of specialization is my master's, which I completed in 2007, was socioeconomic rights, in particular, how the role of the court in relation to the role of government, and in particular, parliament, when it passes legislation. how service delivery and the progressive realization of socioeconomic rights will impact on the various constitutional bodies. The first part of your question, I think, is probably the most difficult. When it comes to Chapter 9 in general, and the Human Rights Commission in particular, I think what is crucial is that the people who serve on the Chapter 9 have a very clear understanding of what exactly the mandate of that particular Chapter 9 is. When it comes to the Human Rights Commission in particular, I mean, when you ask any candidate will say to you, the Human Rights Commission must act independent, impartial, without fear, fame, or prejudice. However, the subtlety lies therein that independence can take many forms. You can either be independent purely in an administrative sense, or you can be so independent that you're virtually isolationist. And somewhere in between is the balance. Also, a one-size-fits-all approach to Chapter 9, and once again the Human Rights Commission in particular, is not suitable. The Constitutional Court has held that when it comes to independence, depending on the mandate of the Chapter 9, you will have varying levels of independence. So I think a proper understanding of that mandate is crucial. What I think I would bring to the Human Rights Commission is a mix of the sort of academic and theoretical aspects, experience in that, but also to try to expand it practically. You know, you can have debates on human dignity and on freedom and on equality, but if you've worked in an informal area, or if you've worked in the township and you work there regularly, you quickly realize that you can have many academic debates about human dignity, but if you have one running tap that serves a community of 2,000 people, then human dignity flies out the window. So I think what is also required is that one should ideally know how government works so that you can deal with it on a practical level as well. So I think the combination of the more theoretical and the practical put together. I've been in government for more than 10 years, so yeah, in a nutshell.
Thank you.
By the kind permission of my friend and colleague Steve Swart, I am getting to ask the first question. Oh. The one he usually asks, that I have a reason why. And Carol, you will be so depressed to learn, as I am, that the Ad Hoc Committee on the Review of the Chapter 9 and other institutions has, notwithstanding Steve's initial good efforts, routinely been called the Osnall Report throughout the last day and a half. Because the fact is, of course, that it was the Carol Johnson, Jane Matsumela, fellow de Debe, Dean Smuts, and Scott Osnall report, not so. And I was glad to see that in your CV you listed yourself as a co-drafter. But this thing has stuck, as was the intention of our dear professor and friend. The question that Steve has been asking people, and initially in the form of the Ad Hoc Review Committee's recommendations, is simply this: what is your understanding of what the relationship ought to be between the executive and the commission, and Parliament and the commission? Now, you have already answered that. You built that answer into your introduction of yourself. But I want to use your introduction now to ask you questions about that. You have just said that the Constitutional Court or a court has ruled that there can be varying levels of independence. I'd like some elucidation because, as far as I know, what the court said was that you can design the appointment mechanism for the various bodies according to the nature of that body and its work, which is not quite the same as saying that there are different levels of independence. And the only other judgment I'm aware of is the certification, which said that the two watchdog Chapter 9, the Public Protector and the Auditor General, the two that are really watchdogs must be appointed by 60% and removed from office by, 2/3. Okay, so if you seem to be nodding in agreement, but you'll address me on that. Then the only other thing I want to
raised with you, feel free to say how you think Parliament can better interact with the Human Rights Commission, because you're familiar with all of the background allegations and arguments and facts. The only other thing I think it's only fair to raise with you, because it's been raised with another candidate, who was a person who changed parties in the course of his parliamentary life, under given circumstances, and I understand specific allegations that bothered Dr. Ambrosini. But just in your case, I think it's perhaps appropriate to indicate, I believe in people following their conscience, you know, you have no difficulty with me, but please just address the issue that you have been associated with more than one political party.
The first question, I mean, the irony of the, let me not call it the Asma report, let me call it the Chapter 9 report, is that we tabled the report in 2007. When was it, the end of last year or the beginning of this year, when the independent panel that assessed Parliament, when they tabled their report, many of the issues that were raised in the Chapter 9 report in 2007 were raised again by the panel. So the irony is that had many of these recommendations actually been put in place earlier, then it wouldn't have been necessary to raise it again in 2009. With regards to the varying levels of independence, I think the first certification judgment, and then there's also a case, Van Rooyen, which is also a constitutional court case, basically says that if you look at, for example, the public protector, it's easier for the public protector to work at more of an arm's length from government because it is a pure and simple watchdog body. With the Human Rights Commission, if you look at its mandate in the preamble and in every legislation, it is in some respects dependent on government to obtain information, particularly when it comes to its socioeconomic rights reports, the Section 32 reports, particularly when it comes to its obligations in terms of the Access to Information Act. But then also it has to make recommendations to organs of state at all levels. So you're going to have a little bit more of a level of call it constructive engagement or interaction with government than you would in the case of a sort of purely watchdog body, hence the differentiation in appointment, etc. When it comes to Parliament in particular, how to put this diplomatically, I think that the relationship between the Human Rights Commission and Parliament can be strengthened in significant ways and in very creative ways. For example, if you look at the annual reports of the Human Rights Commission, the one thing that is apparent is that there are certain government parties who simply do not take the Human Rights Commission seriously. They don't respond to requests for information. When they're asked to advise on what they've done in terms of socioeconomic rights, they either don't respond at all, or they send what is called a null report, saying we have nothing to report. So technically they reported, but they've actually said nothing. Now, what we were proposing, and this is what the independent panel also proposed, is that at some stage you can actually empower Parliament, capacitate the portfolio committee, and help an individual MP in their constituency work if you can get the relationship right. So, for example, if the Human Rights Commission, let's say, picks up a problem in the allocation of antiretrovirals in a particular province, let's say someone brings a complaint, and the Human Rights Commission investigates this, finds out that there's a systemic problem. When the Human Rights Commission then writes its report, it could bring that to the attention of the National Assembly, who could then refer it to the appropriate portfolio committee, who could, as part of its oversight role, take the matter further. It could be debated in the National Assembly itself. And if there is a way of bringing it to the attention of the particular member of Parliament in whose constituency it happens, then you can also empower that MP to take the matter further. So there really is a sort of a mechanism that one can build in to strengthen the role of, or the relationship between Parliament and the Human Rights Commission. Obviously, without Parliament micromanaging the Human Rights Commission or impeding its independence. And once again, I mean, the one thing that really is a problem in terms of the Human Rights Commission, if you look at the public survey, the latest public survey that was done, showed that obviously the IEC was the one Chapter 9 body that was the most well-known to members of the public, followed by the Human Rights Commission. But only 17% of South Africans had actually approached the Human Rights Commission at any one stage. What the public survey also showed was that there was obviously a sort of urban bias, that access to the Human Rights Commission in rural areas was still a problem. And once again, we have to go about this in a creative way. I mean, there is, if you look at Parliament's the latest accountability and oversight model, if you went and you looked at where all the various DCOs are, now there is nothing that prevents the Human Rights Commission from liaising with various DCOs of all political parties and saying this is what we do, because then you'll get the rural coverage which they're not getting at the moment. So there are various ways in which to strengthen that relationship. Also, hopefully, the unit that is being established in the Office of the Speaker will go a long way, provided that it doesn't merely become a postbox, in the sense that it just is a conduit for sending reports through to various committees.
Thank you. On that come, I think we should go to Honorable Swat.
I'm one of the, you know, maybe naive people who do believe that hopefully people do follow their conscience. I did cross from the NNP to the ANC, which is a decision that I do not regret at all. Having said that, I do believe that the system of law crossing, particularly at local government level, there were instances where it became a sort of checkbook politics. I think that is the harsh reality, and one would be naive to think that it did not happen. It did occur, but I think maybe in my experience more so at a municipal level than at national and provincial.
Lovely to see you again, Carol, and welcome back. Nice to see you. Absolutely. Just a few personal issues as to whether you see any possible conflicts of interest, and the issue of if you were available temporary or permanent basis, particularly in view of Mike's base in Johannesburg. How does that, and is there anything that we should, is there any other information that we should be aware of from a personal perspective? Thank you.
I take it when you ask about a conflict of interest whether that would be because of my previous position. I think the fact that someone has held a seat as a public representative. Yep.
Do you hold any elected office positions at the moment? I don't have that in the past. That's 100%. Would that mean candidates like that? That's not that.
No, I'm a branch member, a normal branch member of the ANC still. I'm not on the branch executive committee. I'm not on any party lists. As you know, I specifically did not make myself available for re-election, for obvious reasons, being my imminent meeting with Labour. And I don't mean to start you. And also to slowly but surely want to, that's my own personal issues in the sense that I want to at some stage return to practicing law, but that's moved to next year's plan. As I say, a normal branch member, not that I think that being belonging to a political party would or should automatically disqualify anybody. I think, that the proof is in the pudding as to, If anybody serves in a Chapter 9, I mean, if you look at the
I think the question is answered, Carol, is answered.
That is a bit of a tricky one.
Some of the members who were on the committee last year when we appointed Ms. Govender will recall that that was also an issue. At that stage, it was felt that because of the five candidates that we interviewed, three of them were not available for relocation. So what we did on behalf of the committee was to write to the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission, to Mr. Colopin, who said that, you know, at that stage it was felt that you can't really disqualify somebody for the fact that they can't relocate, because then you're sort of putting an additional criteria that is not really in the legislation or in the... So you can't really force someone to go to Joburg. However, at that stage, it was thought that it would be, just from a technical point of view, easier if somebody was supposed to or could have relocated to Joburg. However, in the case of Ms. Govender, there are provincial offices across the country. And if it is possible for a commissioner to be able to fulfill a certain function from a provincial office, if it's practical to do so, then that would be an option. So I don't know what the committee envisages in this day, at this stage, whether it would be an automatic relocation if you wanted to be full-time or not. Obviously, full-time is a little bit out of the question in the sort of next 3 months or so. I would prefer part-time. But then, of course, the Act does allow for any part-time commissioner to be, if the need arises and if the other commissioners feel the need arises, to approach the National Assembly, to approach the President. You can convert the terms from part-time to full-time if the need arises and obviously if there are the budgets available. So...
thank you, Chair. Just one question. Which is actually two questions in one. Now, the first one is, should you be appointed, what will you do to promote the mandate of the Human Rights Commission, which is to promote human rights and the cause of human rights? What will you do? And secondly, you'll be dealing with people who speak different languages from time to time. And how many are South African languages? That's all.
Yeah, on the language issue, I'm sad to say that I speak only two. The third one very, very badly, so I lack the confidence to often even try. I think what is important from the language perspective, and it's also one of the criteria that is listed in the legislation, is that you should have a Human Rights Commission which is representative of the diversity of our country. So, and to therefore tap in different people's skills and language abilities and the like. The problem with raising public awareness, not only in relation to the Human Rights Commission, but all chapter 9s, really, as I said, the opinion survey showed that the IEC is by far the best, most well-known chapter 9. So the problem really is in relation to all chapter 9s. And once again, there are opportunities that I think that we miss. And when I say we, I mean South Africans in general, but the Parliament and NGOs maybe not as much, but particularly organs of state, where we could be creative in raising human rights issues, which is very much similar... sentiment to what Ms. Mentor raised last week when she tabled her private members' bill. For example, the whole caste disciplinary issue. Ideal opportunity for gender commission, and or human rights commission, but I would say particularly gender commission, to for some level of public discourse as to what is gender stereotyping, why is it wrong, what is the basic difference between gender and sex, what does it mean the rights of people who are intersexed, with the greatest of respect to the Gender Commission, to simply issue a press statement and leave it at that is not going to raise the sort of
protection and promotion of people's human rights or knowledge on the topic. And I mean, one could take that, you know, many different examples. If you take the equality matter between Mr. Malema and the Gender Justice Network, same issue. You know, one can take those issues and be really activistic about it and really raise the levels of public debate. And I don't think we're doing that as well as we could.
Thank you. You don't have to ask questions if you are covered by the...
Just one, I think, for clarity in terms of your availability. So it's basically that, I mean, there's an event happening soon. Then it's basically 3 months that you would want to be off from maternity leave, and then you would be available. Is that what you're saying?
Well, look, it depends on obviously relocation to Cape Town. To Joburg is out of the question, clearly, because we're, you know, based in. So that's obviously something that, you know, one would, if that is what is required to be part time, then that's our full time, then that would be out. If it would be something that one could do from a Cape Town office, then that would be a possibility, as from, you know, either doing part time for 3 months or 6 months and then converting it to full time, or but that would, it would depend on if it's relocation, then I think full time would be out. Unfortunately, just because of practice.
I feel I'm at a reunion and I missed the class. So I'll keep my mouth shut on this one.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And good luck. Thank you for presenting for us. And good luck with the little one. And, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to the members.
Thank you.